Hello, and welcome to the Original Content Podcast. I'm Anthony Ha.
I'm Jordan Crook.
And we are joined once again by Devin Coldaway. Hi, Devin.
Hey there.
And we're going to be reviewing The Haunting of Hill House from Netflix. But before we do that, we are going to talk a little bit about news. And even before the news, we're going to talk about a little review that you guys worked on together of Red Dead Redemption 2, which is not really streaming related, but it's a cool thing that happened this week, and I thought we should talk about it.
It was a very cool thing that happened this week. I mean, Devin and I talked about it extensively, but it is a bonkers game. It is so big and really fun and interesting to play. I'm enamored with it.
Yeah, it really, as I think Jordan put in our headline, it really sort of sets a new standard for this type of immersion, and it shows what is possible in the world of gaming and digital media. The amount of interactivity and the scale and detail of the world, the voice acting and story, like, it's really kind of ridiculous. So you can read our review and hear our thoughts about it, but really you should just be playing it. It came out today on PS4, Xbox One. I think that's it. It's not
that's
on PC
it.
Or anything
yeah,
yet. Yeah.
That's
but you
it
should
right
definitely
now.
Buy it. Like, we can tell you right now that our review is buy it, but if you're interested in our thoughts, we have a full-on 3,000-word review.
We had 3,000 words for early impressions, and honestly, I could put out another, 10,000 words on it.
Yeah,
because it's just, there's so much to say. I've been taking notes. We'll probably do something here in the next few weeks once we feel like we've played through it enough. There's certain things that I'm still hella hung up on, like hunting and what to do with these animal pelts is driving me insane. Truly,
yeah, I got piles
I can't
of them.
Figure it out. Yeah, I can't figure it out. But the story itself, there's just plenty to unpack. And what makes it so spectacular is when you zoom out after playing for a little bit and you realize what Devin was saying, the structural integrity of the story, at least so far, is really interesting. Everything down to the dialogue feels truly authentic, but then you have all these layers of things you can interact with and things you can do, and you have all these elements of time management, and it almost feels structured in a way that when you leave something behind, no matter how minute it is, you want to go back and finish it at some point. There's hours and hours of horseback riding, which should suck, but it's lovely and you're laid back and enjoying it. And to put all those things together in a console game, I mean, that is as rudimentary as you get in terms of controls and stuff. And to put all that together in a game that you just use a controller to play is it's just insane. It boggles the mind, truly. It's very, very good, interesting, huge game. And it makes sense that it took 9 years to make it.
Yeah.
What percentage would you say each of you is, completed of the game?
Oh, man. 10 or 15? I don't know. I've played hours and hours, but you can only fit so many hours into the day when you have a job and other things to do. And I've been playing a lot, and I know Jordan has been playing more, but, there's so much. You could spend hundreds of hours doing all the stuff in it, and the main story probably is, 40 or 50 hours, I would guess. So, yeah, there's a lot to do.
Yeah, well, and it's interesting, too, because when you talk about, what percent done are you, if you're talking about just the story missions, I'm, somewhere around, 38 or 40% done. But that doesn't include all of the challenges, all of the side missions, all of the animals to hunt, all of the stuff to make, all of the horses to buy, all of the clothes to buy. The list goes on and on and on. And this is before they've even introduced online, right? So, I mean, it's just... Yeah, it's hard to even say what percent done you are. Never. Because honestly, the game is so good that I could see myself playing through, taking a month or two off, and then coming back and playing it because it's dynamic. So right mm-hmm. now my honor is at 73% or whatever, which means essentially the decisions I've made in the game have made me 75% a good guy. But if I went back and played it and made myself 25% good guy, right? Like a villain, the game would play different. Certain things would play out differently. The music would be different. The dreams that my character has and the transitions and all that stuff is different. So you could theoretically play it again and have it be like a very different experience game wise, you know? Yeah, it's just nuts. I'm enamored, like I said.
All right, people should check it out.
Yeah, for sure.
You may have picked up on that. There's a little bit of enthusiasm here. So the one piece of news I wanted to touch on really briefly was just today, again, we're recording this on Friday, Filmstruck, which was a streaming service created by Turner Classic Movies. It also had the Criterion Collection in it. Warner announced today that they're shutting it down. And I think, like, it's one of those things where, to be completely honest, I didn't necessarily spend as much time on Filmstruck as I probably should have. It's kind of like the, like, streaming equivalent of letting, like, New Yorker issues kind of pile up. You just feel like you should be spending more time on it, but it also feels a little bit like homework sometimes. But I, you know, it is because I think one of the things people have been talking, I've been, like, reading more about in the last few months is the fact that streaming in general, you know, because it has a smaller library than, say, the full library of DVDs or VHS cassettes, and then it tends to sort of prioritize newer stuff. It just means that a lot of old films just don't really make that transition. They don't become available. And Filmstruck was one of the few places where you could actually get this, like, huge library of classic films. And so the fact that it's shutting down the landscape is really missing a really key piece now.
Yeah, it seems it's definitely a powerful resource. And, you know, I love classic films, and it was nice to know that there was that resource there that was exactly. dedicated to that. You know, I love TCM. I love watching old movies. Criterion Collection is such a, like, expertly curated selection of films and, you know, extra content. So, yeah, I'm sad that it's not there. But like you, you know, it was, you know, I'm busy watching the 50 other things and playing these other games and stuff. So I don't always have time to go back and watch, you know, Psycho for the third time or something, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, I do think some of that stuff is going to come back online. Like before Filmstruck, Criterion Collection had a lot of their movies up on Hulu. And I think part of the reason Filmstruck is being shut down is because Warner Media is going to be launching their own streaming service next year. And I think they're kind of shutting down all the smaller streaming services that their different subsidiaries run. So I think a lot of this stuff will be back online at some point. It was just, you know, I was glad that Filmstruck existed for a while it did, even if it wasn't necessarily super popular. Well, let's move on to our main review then, which is The Haunting of Hill House. It is a series on Netflix. It is sort of based on the novel of the same name by Shirley Jackson, which we can kind of talk about a little. It is, I don't know, so one of you guys want to try to summarize it?
The show or the book?
The show, yeah. Let's.
Well, I would say the show is about a family that has a past at the titular Hill House, and it switches between the past and the present, and it shows how the spooky, weird things that happened in the house, this haunted Hill House, have resonated and changed them and created this sort of fractured family of damaged people in the present. And there's a lot of interplay between their experiences in the past at this haunted house and how they are as people and a family in the present. And I think that it's very dissimilar to the novel, which was much more self-contained and has almost nothing to do with it, to be honest. But right. there are themes in common, and it's extremely well made in a lot of ways. So that's the sort of capsule version there.
I think the one other thing I would add plot wise is just that there is that clearly there was like this one horrible night when the family was younger, and a lot of the main characters were kids, where something terrible happened. Their mother died in ways that are not very clear, and that's sort of this thing that the flashbacks kind of like circle around is that you know something horrible happened.
Was it
there.
One horrible night?
Well, there's lots of horrible multiple? Nights, but there's.
It seems like there were many horrible.
There were many, but there was the one. The one the where final they left. Night. Yeah,
where kind of yeah, yeah. I guess they call it the final night. It's the night that everything kind of came to a head, and where before everyone was kind of like, oh, this is kind of weird. Bad things are happening, but okay, and then suddenly that's when shit happened, even right. though it's not totally clear what the shit is yet.
Yeah.
Right. So, to me, as someone who doesn't watch shows like this very much and tends to lean towards like primetime comedy dramedy stuff. This structurally is shockingly similar to This Is Us. Huh. Like, you have a past, present, and maybe like, you know, near present or like near past timelines running concurrently in a family of like five people, essentially. This is six, I guess.
Seven, so I think, total.
They're
seven in the past, six in the present because of the mother's not in the present.
Yeah.
Wait, so there are five kids?
There's
the oldest son. Mm-hmm. There's the younger son. Oh, yeah, and there's three girls. The little girl and then the two middle girls.
Well, how are you comparing it to
This Is Us? The point is that it's just like, it is a story about a family. I think, like, you know, beyond it being a scary, creepy horror thriller thing, it's a family story. Like, it's contained within the characters of this family for the most part. And it's just got the parallel timeline. So I was getting, like, even though it's a completely different plot line, like, structurally it felt like echoes of This Is Us. So that's the most analysis I can bring to this show.
I actually, you know, I found that it is actually similar, not in tone or anything like that, but like you compare it to This Is Us. I actually am getting shades of Lost, because Lost had this constant back and forth between the story on the island and then the story of the story. And the difference is with Lost, the flashbacks and stuff were just interminable and boring and usually irrelevant. But in Hill House, they are usually pretty relevant, and they are often, you know, the reason why a person has this phobia, or they're the story of why they are the way they are. Sometimes they are, sometimes they're not, but they're intimately connected, at least in the storytelling way, and relevant. So, but there is that structure, that back and forth structure, that I think Lost and a few other shows have helped popularize.
Well, and I think with Haunting on Hill House, it's like, if the jump in time feels crazy, because the present day world, while it seems very glum in certain ways, is still, it feels very present and like relatable, whereas like it can't be that long ago that they were at Hill House, but it feels like Victorian almost. And I think that's a lot in due to the decor, but it's also like the acting and the dialogue, like it feels very formal, like from a really different time. Like it feels like they're hundreds of years old, these people. Do you know what I mean?
Well, I mean,
does anybody else get those vibes?
Well, I was going to say, I mean, one of the things that reinforces that, I mean, I didn't necessarily think that it was like Victorian, but I know what you mean, that it feels very, very removed. And part of it is also because so like all of the flashbacks, with some exceptions, like that are like a handful of exceptions, but in general, almost all the flashbacks take place in the house. And so it's this very kind of isolated world where it can be sort of hard to figure out, like, you can sort of do the math and figure out that I guess it would probably be, you know, roughly the
90s or the 80s.
Early to mid 90s. But like it doesn't matter in a way, because almost everything is so completely self-contained in this house. And then in the present day, it's this much more sprawling story where each of the different kids now grown up, you know, well, mostly it's split up between Boston and LA, but they each have their own lives. And so you see a lot more of 2018, whereas you see almost nothing except for the house in the past.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's super true. And with all the focus on like doors and doorknobs and locks
and keys,
like that feels even more isolated, you know, like in that house.
But I agree with you, Jordan, that the past segments, and I'm sure that this is deliberate, the dialogue, the acting, the lighting, all the stuff is done to give it a sort of storybook feel. Everything is all set up and very sort of staged and set and filmed in a way that makes it much more like a story is being told, whereas the present is filmed and shot in a much more straightforward, like, drama manner, and there's less of the very careful setups and the sort of not stilted dialogue, but the, like, you know, two children having a conversation about the ghost that's obviously leading to some kind of horrible ghost encounter. Because you know that's where it's going every single time, where they're like, I heard something in the closet. And you're like, oh, God, don't go to the closet then.
What made you draw these pictures? You know?
Yeah. And you're like, oh, Jesus, oh, this thing shit. In the picture is coming. Oh, God. Because it is scary. I don't know about you guys, but I am a little scaredy cat. I watch this show with a pillow held in front of my face. I'm not joking. And I block the screen when I know something scary is going to happen. And I sort of watch the top tenth of the screen. Because it's a very scary show. Some, you know, very, very scary movie lovers may not find it that scary, but it's scaring the shit out of me.
It's kind of an interesting kind of scary. And I think part of it has to do with exactly what you were saying earlier, Devin, with the pulling in and out of like a regular show. Like, mm-hmm. there's still scary moments that happen in the present, no doubt. You know what I mean? But they're almost always complemented by this in and out motion with the flashbacks that... The flashbacks are almost always scary.
Yeah.
So you get coaxed into this, oh, we're back in the present, everything's fine. And then something scary happens. And then they throw you back into a flashback and you're scared again. And then you come back to the real world and you're like, oh, everything's okay. But no, it's not. Like, you know, the oscillation, I feel like, heightens how scary it is. Because really, if you think down to like granularly, like what is happening on screen, there are things out there that are far scarier, in my opinion. But this is very, like, traditionally spooky almost, you know? But it's done in a way that heightens it so much, which I think is really good, because then it's not shock value in your face scary. It's, like, this almost nostalgic kind of scary, but it's, like, triple. It's on steroids, you know?
And it, fortunately, for if you're like me and you get scared easily and are get really anxious watching scary stuff, it is worth saying that, A, the show is really good and you should watch it, but B, the scary parts are telegraphed like a mile off, with some small exceptions, which we'll talk about, like the background ghosts. But they, like, it'll always be really obvious something scary is going to happen, because there's little kids gathering around like a creepy hole, or like, you know, hold it, I don't want to spoil anything, but it's always really obvious when something scary is going to happen. It's still scary, but you're like, you have plenty of time to get into scare mode and hold up that pillow, or, you know, get your hands up over your eyes or whatever.
It does that thing that I think a lot of horror movies do, but it does it even more aggressively, of there's a specific way the camera moves when you know something scary is going to happen, because it usually starts playing with your perspective and emphasizing certain things of like, oh, it's weird that this character is framed so that you can just see all this darkness behind them, or like, there's all this stuff that I know you're not showing me right now, so I know suddenly we're going to cut and there's going to be a ghost standing right behind her, or whatever. And so you can sort of gear up. And it's interesting because, you know, because of this structure, you know that none of the kids are going to die, at least in those flashback segments. And yet they're still really scary, because it's still just, I mean, the imagery is so unsettling. Like, no one, you know, like, there are deaths in the show, but even more than the scary stuff, those are completely telegraphed. You know when someone has died or is going to die. But it still scares the shit out of me.
Well, the one thing that, as you mentioned, the way that the camera works and stuff like that, like, the background ghosts we have to talk about, and this isn't really a spoiler to say, but they've hidden ghosts in the show, because as the showrunners have said, they want the viewers to feel sort of like the characters are feeling, which is that they're being watched, there's this, there are presences that they're not aware of, and so on. And you may notice stuff in the background, as I did, and be like, wait, is that? And then it'll cut and there'll be nothing there. But then it's absolutely deliberate, and there's a bunch of like horrifying figures in the background or faces in windows that you will not notice unless you're looking for them. But once you start looking for them, it makes you very nervous, because it's, you guys remember It Follows, and how basically, it's a great movie, and part of why it created this sense of dread in you, because the monster, you know, or ghost or whatever you want to call it, could be in the background at any time. It could be any person, anywhere at any time, and it wouldn't even be necessarily like scary, like the ghosts are in the background here, where it's just like someone standing in a shadow. You can barely see their face, but you're always clued in. You're always sort of, you're looking for this, and it makes you nervous because you never know what to expect I guess it kind of sounded like I was going to add something onto that.
Yeah, it did.
Definitely fucking. You didn't expect that sentence to end right then, did you?
Oh my God, no, it didn't. Oh wow, that was like, I was like, he has to either his technical difficulties or he's like formulating his final thought. Right. One of the two. It was no way you were done. Oh my God. Yeah, I agree with you though. I think I didn't even realize. I don't think I spotted a single hidden ghost. Only the ones that they really wanted me to see did I see. And then you showed this article. Vulture's so good at this, too. They did the same thing with sharp objects, all right. The words that you didn't see, like all the hidden writing in it. And, yeah, I'm definitely a little more nervous to continue watching. I'm only two episodes in. And as someone who really doesn't like shows like this, I could totally see myself continuing on. What about you guys? Is this something you're in it for? In it to win it now? Or particularly Devin, because I feel like Anthony's already gone.
Yeah. I'm definitely in it to the end. I have my own little issues with the show that I am getting over, which, like, for instance, the switching between the past and the present is usually done in this really on-the-nose way where it's like, you know, slow zoom on a doorknob and the kid's hand approaches it and then cut to a doorknob in the present. And you're like, okay, that's kind of cool the first 20 times. But then yeah. It's like every single time it switches, there's always the little noise that you know it's going to switch and or else a ghost is going to come out. And it's kind of like every single time it's one of these like one-to-one transitions. And it's like, okay, guys, like we get the idea. There are similarities between the past and the present. But that kind of bugged me. And I think the show is like massively overlit. I wish that they would have done something more with the... like better lighting because everybody always has fill lights on them and stuff and it makes the whole show look really flat to me except in very rare circumstances.
Talk a little bit more about what you mean by fill lights.
So what I mean by fill light is they don't allow people to just be in the dark. They always light them and then darken the sort of scene so that you can see someone's whole face just sort of dimly lit in, you know, like a blue light, like it's supposed to be starlight or moonlight. But they never let anything be truly dark. Like all the rooms, they're never dark. They're always, you know, kind of bright, but then, you know, dimmed in post to make it look darker than it is. And it makes the, instead of having there be like a contrast between actual dark and actual light, which can be very scary or very moody. The movie we talked about, Hold the Dark, did it really well with this kind of like very careful lighting and very high contrast lighting. But this feels like, it feels very networky the way that it's shot and lit. And it ends up kind of subtracting from the horror and the scenery to me because it's everything is so evenly lit that it produces this. Maybe it's something to do with the HDR or the way that Netflix is shooting these days, but it makes it seem kind of, I don't know, just sort of gray rather than black and white, like in terms of every color and tone.
I know what you mean. How many episodes are you in?
Four.
Okay, yeah. I will say that I know what you mean, that they're definitely, I think, especially in some of those, I'm thinking about like the scenes with the kids and they're like frightened of something in the room and you can always see... If you don't see what's in the room, it's because it's cut off, not because it's too dark to see what's going on.
Yeah.
I think there are a few exceptions where I think they specifically turn the lights on and off. And I think sort of the most notable one is in episode 6, where it sort of takes place during this storm. And then you will get moments of just complete blackness and shadow. But you're right that there's a lot of other stuff where it's just kind of this kind of dark blue.
Yeah, I've never really liked that day to night stuff, but so that's kind of a personal thing. A lot of people won't notice it, but it does, the show has a flatness to the look that I don't really enjoy, but I think that otherwise it's very well made, and it took me a little while to get used to how it's shot, but I understand it now, and the differences between the past and the present and how they light it, how they color it, and stuff like that. There's definitely a lot of attention done to it, but I have some personal issues with it. They should have considered my opinions before they produced the show, obviously.
So I would say that for people who check it out, I mean, I think it starts out already pretty strong, but it also gets a lot better. And in particular, I mean, I hate to say this knowing you guys are only 2 and 4 episodes in, but I would say episodes 5 and 6 are just both really, really, really good and really scary. So episode 5, there's this creature that you see from the very beginning called the Bent-Necked Lady. And episode 5 actually shows you, like, really shows you what the Bent-Necked Lady is. And it's really upsetting and really, really well done.
I haven't seen that yet.
And then the... Well, the Bent-Necked Lady, she shows up in the first episode. She's the monster.
Yeah, in the first scene, really? Isn't it? Like, yeah, she's the lady that shows up in the very first scene in the show. Like, not spoiler, this is the first scene in the show, but, like, she is introduced right from the very beginning. So you know that she's one of the primary sort of ghosts in the house. She has
a
name.
But you don't see her in the first episode.
She's always in shadow until the big reveal in episode 5, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so I missed her. But she wasn't, like, made obvious. It's not the same person that was hovering over the little girl.
Oh, it is. Yeah, it is.
Yeah,
the same.
That's that. It's the same. That's the lady.
Her neck wasn't even bent.
Man, you can't even see the neck. Relax.
It's weird because
not be her. Her neck isn't bent.
what do you call it? Like the look. The defining thing about her look is the fact that her face is in shadow and her hair is falling down, like in this way that obscures like sort of like her whole body and face. But everyone just calls her the Bent-Necked Lady, which is it doesn't. That's not actually the most interesting thing about her look.
She looks like the girl from The Ring, honestly.
Yes.
Just wearing black.
That's fair.
It's very, feels very, what's the word that I'm looking for? Derivative of The Ring character. Which probably is derivative of something else. Horror is horror.
That look goes back pretty far, but yeah, I know what
you're saying. The girl in The Ring is such a good look that I understand why other people would want to borrow it.
Yeah, why it's terrifying. There's a reason.
Yeah.
Something about it.
But then episode 6, I think, is even better. It's basically, it's called Two Storms, and it jumps back and forth between the present and the past, but which is true of, all the episodes, but it takes place with these two parallel storms, and it's done in these really, really long single-take shots. So I think the first shot of the episode takes 17 minutes, and it encompasses both the past and the present. So there's times where they walk from one room, which is in the present, into a different room, which is in the past. And it's just, it's amazing. I mean, some of the writing in that episode, I think, doesn't quite live up to the sort of style of how they're making it. But just the fact that they pulled it off is so good. And to your point, Devin, I mean, I think that's also an episode where they really do have true darkness and take advantage of it. It's a really, really scary episode.
Gotcha. Yeah, I'll look forward to that. I would say to new watchers, like, at least watch the first 3 episodes or so, because you'll get a sense of how the show is actually structured. Because the first one I wasn't super excited by, but then when I went to the second and third, I was like, okay, I see what's going on here. I'm getting used to the look, I'm getting used to the style, and there's definitely a lot more pathos to it than I was expecting.
Well, one of the things that's about the format of the show is that the first 5 episodes or so, each of them focuses on one of the Crane children.
Yeah.
And I have to say, because, Jordan, earlier on, you were having trouble remembering how many there were. And I definitely had this moment in the first episode where it starts off in the past, and there's, like, this thing where one of the characters has woken up from a nightmare, and people keep sticking their heads out of their doors, being like, what's going on? And, like, it just seemed like this endless, like, clown car of kids sticking their heads out, being like, hey! And you're like, oh my god, there's so many children in this show.
It doesn't help that, like, the mother from the past, and the eldest daughter, and the second eldest daughter all look strikingly similar. Like, particularly the oldest daughter, and the mom.
Yes.
Like, do they not look identical? Is it the same fucking actress?
I think that there could be a familial, strain, but I would say that I would go with Carla Gugino over the actress. The mother is, like, definitely meant to look, like, beautiful and angelic in the past. Like, I've talked about this with my friends. And I know that there's this tragedy associated with her, but they deliberately picked this, like, really beautiful actress, and they light her like a little angel, and she's always has these angelic and nice things to say. And she's like, and then I think they deliberately picked a sort of more severe, angular person to be the kind of mother figure in the present, because it's a more realistic time. It's a more practical part of the show. And so you have this, like, less angelic, more like realistic person who is your mother figure.
But they do, you have to admit that they, at the very least, are styled very similarly and have very similar looks. And when you don't know anyone's name or what the hell is going on, you're like, why does this one woman have six names? Like, explain to me. But yeah, I was having trouble keeping track of everyone.
I genuinely think they must have cast for resemblance, because I think particularly, I think you're right that the mother in the past and then Shirley, the eldest daughter in the present, look very similar. And then also young Shirley and old Shirley, I think, like, if you told me they were really mother and daughter, I would believe it. Like, it is confusing, but I think it also is one of those things where in other movies you kind of are like, oh, we're going to believe they're brother and sister. But there are actually two famous actors who don't really, you know, who are both white, but otherwise don't look, and have the same hair color, but otherwise don't look similar at all. And this is definitely the opposite of that.
Yeah, it feels like it was very, like, meticulous casting, you know?
Yeah.
And I didn't like that at first. I thought, oh man, too many kids. This is going to be really hard to keep track of them. But I think it's one of the things where they really take advantage of the format and the fact that they have extra time. And so by the end of the fifth episode, which I know is a lot, that's asking a lot, but by the end of the fifth episode, I definitely felt like I had a great handle on who each of the kids were, and like they each had a really even before then, but definitely after we'd sort of done the full tour, then I was like, okay, I see why you have so many children characters, and I feel like they're all distinct characters, not just this sort of mass of child actors. I guess one last thing maybe we should touch on, which we alluded to, is the fact that the show has almost nothing to do with the book. And I will say that personally, I didn't have a problem with that. I like the book. I don't find the book particularly scary, which I know is probably blasphemous to some people who think it's like one of the great horror novels of all time. I'm totally fine that they took the name and then did something else with it. I'm less crazy about the fact that they will sometimes just take little elements from the book and drop them in, because it almost feels like more funny than scary then. It feels like it's kind of like winking at you. And so I almost wish that they just dropped all the references then.
Yeah, you know, it's been a little while since I've read the book, and I really liked it a lot. I wouldn't say that it's like particularly scary, but it is a classic of sort of modern gothic horror. And there are a lot of nods and winks, but some of them are explicit, some of them aren't. Like, sometimes there will be like a ghost encounter that, you know, you're like, oh wait, that's straight out of the book. And the character names and some of their themes are out of the book too. Theodora, Luke, and Nell are the names of the people who go to the house, and they have sort of similar aspects. Like, Theodora is sensitive. Luke is sort of he's a storyteller, and he's always drawing in the show. And right, Nell
kind
is
of an
like
asshole.
The yeah, and Nell is like the she's the kind of like nervous affected one, the one most affected by the ghosts, and the primary narrator in the book. And she seems to be a very central figure in the show too, although I haven't got her episode is next, I believe, so I'm not completely sure. But there's definitely there are references. Sometimes they take it a little too far. Because the show and the book are so different, it doesn't always make sense. And opening the whole show with like the quote, like the famous opening quote from the book of the, you know, what walks at Hill House walks alone, et cetera, it was sort of a false start for me, because I was like, look, you can't cash in on the quality of the book when your show has almost nothing to do with the book. They stand on their own, but it did put me off a little bit, and does when they do those little nods.
Sorry, I just have a question, because the book, the oldest son, whatever his name is, Steve, wrote a book called The Haunting on Hill House, and there is a book in the real world called The Haunting on Hill House,
which this show is based on. Yes.
Right.
Yes.
So, in the real book, is there a narrative book called The Haunting of Hill House?
No.
Yes.
Wait.
Oh, no, no. Wait, what are you asking? I don't understand what you're asking.
I think she's saying, if you read the book The Haunting of Hill House, is there a book within the world of that, within that narrative, also called The Haunting of Hill House, the way there is in the show?
No. So there is a Hill House.
And they used a quote from the actual book, The Haunting of Hill House, in his fictitious book within the show world.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Got it. Sorry, I'm just trying to catch up. I didn't read the book.
But it's clear that the book that he wrote is not the same as the Shirley Jackson book. I mean, first of all, because the Shirley Jackson book isn't purporting to be real, but also because the plots are just completely different. The book is, you know, three people who, plus a sort of this older professor figure, who none of whom is related, who all go to Hill House. And then, like, vaguely spooky shit happens, for most of the book. Whereas, and there's no, like, tragedy in the past. There's no jumping around in time. There's none of this stuff about, like, that they're all siblings. It's just people go to a house and, like, you know, spooky stuff happens.
Is this supposed to be, like, a prequel or a sequel to that? Or no. It's just unrelated?
No. It's, like, okay. Totally unrelated. You should read Same the book. House. It's very good. But, yeah, it's basically it mainly just has the house, a haunted house in common, and it's called Hill House, and that's about where the similarities end, except for a few themes with the characters.
Right, character names and certain aspects of their personality. So, like, if you go to this expecting, you know, an adaptation of The Haunting of Hill House, you're going to be very dissatisfied if you're just like, okay, it's a show that happens to be called The Haunting of Hill House that may try to honor Shirley Jackson in certain ways. You'll probably like it a lot more.
Yeah, I agree.
Jordan, are you going to keep watching?
Yeah, potentially. I'm in the middle of a bunch of stuff. I'm watching Making a Murderer, the second season, which we'll bring to you listeners soon. But I'm in the middle of that, so I took a break to watch two episodes of this Haunting thing. And I didn't hate it, so I could see myself wandering back to it, but not like, I'm not going to do it earnestly. Like, it'll just have to happen to me.
Cool. Well, before we wrap up, as always, I'll just remind everyone that they can subscribe on Apple Podcasts or the podcast app of their choice. They can also leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. And Devin and Jordan, thanks again.
My pleasure.
Yeah, thanks. Lots of fun.
Woo. Happy Halloween!
Happy Halloween!